Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
This is A Cult of Personality podcast episode number 101, featuring an interview with Marcus Katz about his new book, Tarosophy, published by Salamander and Sons. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. Thanks again to the subscribers of the Occult of Personality membership section who fund each and every show, as well as the generous listeners who have sponsored this episode, namely Artavan and Steve. If you'd like to sponsor a future episode of the show, simply click the PayPal donate button on the website. Donations of any amount are appreciated. Now, in episode number 101, I chat with Marcus Katz. You can find him online at tarotprofessionals.com. Marcus is the director of Tarot Professionals and the Faraway Center. He has studied and taught tarot for 30 years and has delivered more than 10,000 face-to-face readings. He's also written a wonderful new book entitled Tarosophy, Tarot to Engage Life, Not Escape It, published by Salamander and Sons. In this interview, we concentrate primarily on his remarkable new book, which is simply one of the most interesting and practical books about tarot that I've encountered. It's also received high praise from many of the leading lights in the tarot community. After listening to Marcus talk about his new book and his insights about tarot, I think you'll understand why. Marcus Katz, welcome to the show. Really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thank you very much, Greg. I'm very, very happy to be here.
Yes, and it's wonderful to speak with you, especially on this, which is the occasion of the publication of your new book, Tarosophy. Am I pronouncing that correctly? I just want to make sure.
I believe so. It's it is a generated word. It's also a trademarked word. And the story behind its generation is interesting. We might cover that later. However, it could be pronounced Tarosophy or Tarosophy, depending on which side of the Atlantic you may be.
Okay, excellent. So, Tarosophy, Tarosophy, Tarot to Engage Life, Not to Escape It, published by Salamander and Sons. Very, very excellent book. I got a preview of it, and I very much enjoyed it. Wanted to mention that before we begin. And before we actually speak about the book, I'd like to hear a little bit about your background and experience, especially with regard to tarot and esoteric studies.
Okay, well, I've been studying, reading, and teaching tarot for 30 years. When I was at school, we had a religious education class, and a very forward-thinking teacher had a New Age practitioner come in and give us an afternoon lecture on what the New Age was. And as a result, we did things like dowsing, and she read tarot cards for us, and she gave us a brief lecture on astrology. And I was very enthused by this. In fact, so enthused that I went home and joined the adult library, got a special dispensation to go up to the adult library, borrowed a book on tarot, which was, I think, Stuart Kaplan's book. It was the only one they had. And my father owned one of the first photocopiers for his company. And it was a huge device. And I laid the Stuart Kaplan book with the major cards from the Marseille deck face down on the photocopier, photocopied the cards, cut them out, stuck them onto cardboard with what I had to hand, which was sellotape, sort of sticking tape, then read the rest of the book over the weekend, then went back to school on the Monday with these cards in an old coffee grind bag that I thought looked pretty cool, dangling off my belt as I went back into school. And offered tarot readings to my friends. I must have had some sort of management or marketing Nous back then, because I realized if I position myself in the cafeteria by the queues for the food and got there first, I could sit on the table shuffling these strange cards, and people stood in the queue would then come up to me to ask me what I was doing. And I started reading tarot then, and since then I have read for, I've estimated anything between 10 to 12,000 people face-to-face over the years. So I've certainly done my time on the cold face of tarot.
Yeah, that's a vast experience, I would have to say.
Yeah, I think it's interesting as well, because tarot was not my mainstay in that sense, in that it actually threaded all of the other work I was doing. I was far more interested at the time in witchcraft, and I applied to join a coven when I was 16 and got turned away from the coven for being too young, but got given a reading list of books, which at the time were the only few published books on witchcraft, which was Witchcraft for Today by Valiente. And I went back to the group on my 18th birthday and was initiated. It was a Gardnerian traditional group, and the High Priestess and Priest were initiated by Patricia Crowther, who, of course, was Gerald Gardner's High Priestess. So the Book of Shadows I hand copied is only one generation away from Gardner's original. And it's quite interesting because it does show similarities with some of the published versions and some significant differences as well. So I practiced witchcraft as my chosen practice. I also was briefly a member of the Typhonian OTO and corresponded with Kenneth Grant. I was, when Chaos Magic first started, I was one of the few people, I think, that bothered to follow the syllabus in Liber Null, write my own diary for it, send it to Pete Carroll, and as a result got invited to stay with Pete a couple of times, and helped me develop my own appreciation of both Chaos Magic, its differences to Thelema, how it worked with my Gardnerian practice. In the meantime, my main interest in amongst all of that was the Golden Dawn, because they seem to have synthesized so many different systems, including the tarot. So we, some colleagues and I was in my early 20s at the time, established a Golden Dawn temple. We actually built a full Golden Dawn temple. We invited practitioners to join us in a series of rituals, for example, zodiacal rituals, elemental rituals, and in the background, Innistry rituals. So we had people like Ian Fries, Jan Preyes, from Shamanism, Freya Answin with Rune Magic, Maggie Ingalls came to do some work with us, who established the Mart Current. And so we had a quite interesting crucible of occult and esoteric work going on in a very nondescript building in a very nondescript town in the middle of Derbyshire in England for several years. After a while, I continued on with my tarot, my witchcraft. I started writing and researching more about the Golden Dawn. Over the last 20 years, I've been lucky enough to work with a lot of the materials in the Warburg Institute, so Crowley's material and the original Golden Dawn papers. I think it mainly culminated in my work about 6 years ago now, for which there's a book in production called After the Angel. I decided that I would attempt the Abramelin ritual as it is written from the French version rather than the German version. And that was about 6 years ago. And as it says on the instructions of that particular ritual, it did entirely change my life. I changed my career. I changed my home and made a lot of other significant changes to the way I teach as a result. So that's really where Terosophy grew out of, is a ferment of all of those different systems into using the esoteric principles to fully engage with life in a very magical and yet spiritual sensibility.
Tell us more about the approach you took to writing it and your intent in writing it and what makes it so unique.
I guess the main thing is that I use tarot as a living wisdom, as a lyrical language of the soul engaged with life rather than escaping it, which I'll explain a little bit about in a moment, if I may. I think up to date, the tarot has evolved into an alphabet. Everybody is aware that it has an A, B, and a C, and to some extent that they form an alphabet in a particular sequence, and you can make different words with it. What I've tried to do with Terosophy is take that up a logical layer into the language that tarot is. And I've used that language to speak about life, to speak about our everyday life and our magical life intertwined with each other in a very dynamic dialogue between what arises in our perception as life and what our magical reality may well be. And I see tarot as an interface and a language between those two aspects. So most of the exercises in Terosophy are very engaged exercises. For example, there are way too many exercises and books, and this is what I mean by escaping life, where tarot is used as a crutch or a distraction to real life. For example, one could do an exercise for a week where you go through your tarot deck and you look at the figures and you compare them to famous politicians or your favorite pop stars. You see if you can spot a pop star somewhere in there. Now, I also work as a therapist and a trainer, particularly in NLP, which we'll perhaps come on to. And to me, being able to see faces in shapes and images that weren't actually originally designed to be in there is quite a psychotic sort of installation to give people. And also, after a week of doing that exercise, what has changed? What has actually happened? Whereas if you did an alternative exercise, I might propose, and took out the court cards, the 16 court cards from a tarot deck, you broke them into two piles, you shuffled them, you took out one of those court cards, your partner took out another of those court cards, and then you made love in the style that you imagine those two court cards would make love in, then that's a slightly more engaged, a slightly more hopefully joyous use of the tarot than the previous exercise. And also, it would probably change your life, particularly when your partner wondered how many of the different 16 cards, how many different combinations of them there could be. And that's exactly the sort of exercise that I have in Terosophy. Tarot to actually engage with life. One of the main innovations in Terosophy, of which there are several, is the concept of gated spreads. And this is quite unique to Terosophy. With a gated spread, instead of just laying out a single spread for a reading, what you do is you retro-engineer from a goal how you get towards that goal, and you split the spread up to guide you along the paths to that particular goal. than is to say you do a spread and it tells you what you need to do before the next spread. And the next spread only makes sense, and its answer only makes sense, if you have performed activities based on the first spread. So it builds up and it guides you to a final spread, a final gate, if you like, and some of the gated spreads have 3 gates or 4 gates, 5 gates, that can only answer someone who has done the work in between each of the other spreads. It only makes sense if you have had life experience within the tarot itself. And that really shows you some of these weird hidden paths that are available to us in life, things that you wouldn't normally see in your actual everyday real life. And that's something we're quite proud about here with Tarotopy, is the concept of gated spreads. We run several of them throughout the year. For example, we've got one for the Valentine's Day, which we ran last year. And we had marriage guidance counselors on that, relationship experts, and so forth. And for most of the people, it changed their life. And I believe that if you do a tarot reading, it should change someone's life. Otherwise, it's a wasted opportunity. Not all tarot readings are like that, but it's grand when they are. The gated spread is an example of that.
It's fantastic. I have to say, from my own perspective approaching this book, it was interesting because I'm not someone who has done readings or divination, but I'm very familiar with tarot imagery and using Kabbalistic interpretations and correspondences with the cards and things of that nature. So part of your book felt very familiar, but the other part of your book felt very unfamiliar. But the way I think you teach it is easy. It's easy to pick up because of some of the ways that you explain things. And one of the things you mentioned is NLP. So maybe we could spend a few minutes talking about that too.
For sure. It was about 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago, I was working in Switzerland, and I was introduced to NLP. Somebody said that to me, "Oh, you're interested in magic, you must be interested in NLP, or you'll love NLP." I'd never heard of it. They loaned me one of the first NLP books, I think The Structure of Magic, strangely enough it was called. I took it home that night, and the following morning I was just enthused beyond measure about this, what appeared at the time to me certainly to be a accepted or culturally standardized way of looking at the way the mind works to represent reality. I'd always, you know, considered that to be part of magic, and somewhat of a sideways pursuit almost. And here I was reading a book that appeared to be about linguistics and psychology, talking about exactly some of the things that I was working with magic, suggesting that, you know, the way we represent the world to us is our reality, and we can change that reality. So to me, NLP is a way of looking at the way we represent the world to ourselves, usually in terms of language and in terms of the senses, and then making changes, significant changes, to that representation. However, with the tarot, my main interest was I was studying NLP and being exposed to lots of tarot readers at the same time. So it became almost inevitable, and then I encouraged this, that I would model using NLP tarot readers. NLP purports that it can model excellence or model genius. And so there was me exposed to hundreds of people. I would go around psychic fairs and sit in front of hundreds of tarot readers, one after another, and ask them to do readings for me. And here were people who said they could see the future, that they could know things about you that no one else could know, that they had a deep intuition and so forth. And as I watched them, I used the NLP techniques to model what was going on unconsciously. And as a result, developed new teaching methods that I now teach my beginner students to do the things that experienced tarot readers have learned to do unconsciously over 20 years. And, you know, we teach that right up front. So perhaps I can give one example.
Yeah, that would be great.
I noticed, and most people might notice this, that when tarot readers read, they often don't leave the cards on the table. They unconsciously, even if they're talking straight to you, their fingers are often placed on the cards, and quite often they move them in particular patterns. Mm-hmm. And this is quite, you might even consider it a bit of a nervous habit. However, to NLP, there is nothing accidental about the way the unconscious processes things. So what I noticed was that there were lots of different types of movement when people were talking about different types of cards. And so one of the examples on our beginner's course, when we teach what to a lot of people is a quite complex system of elemental dignities, the way cards relate to each other based on their elemental correspondences. One of the things we teach our beginners is to stare at a card that they can choose out of the deck, have one card either side of that card in their peripheral vision, lay one of their left fingers on the card on the left, one of their right fingers on the card on the right. And as they stare at the central card, allow themselves to feel how they are moving the two cards either side. And because they have those two cards in their peripheral vision, because they know a little bit about the cards, and because they have their conscious attention focused on the central card, they find very spookily, like a seance, their hands moving the other two cards. Quite often they'll jam them in really fast. Sometimes they'll make one do a wide circle and leave the other dead still. Sometimes they'll bring them closer together. And what happens is they learn instinctively what I call natural dignities, which is a unconscious processing of their knowledge of those cards and the relationship between those cards expressed in a very visible and kinesthetic way. There's actually a similar sort of experiment in the book called Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, which I won't go into now, but it demonstrates how the body can know things a lot faster than the unconscious, and the unconscious then a lot faster than the conscious. So we teach those sorts of techniques to students so that they end up doing the things experienced tarot readers do right at the beginning.
That's fascinating. And I don't want to get too off topic here, but I just wondered if you could say a few words about this knowing sense, this identifying with the tarot imagery that's going on at an unconscious or subconscious level.
It's a fascinating thing because I honestly don't know. I do believe that tarot has, in effect, stabilized into a structure of 78 cards, 22 major cards, and so forth. I sometimes ask people, I've done some very mass experiments that helped me write Tarotsophy. For example, I would ask a whole group of people on a forum, is there a card that if we could take out of the deck, no one would notice that much? And if so, which of the cards is it? Or which card could you take out of the deck with the least impact on the functionality of the deck? Or is there an experience in your life that is not covered by one card in the deck? In effect, what I was doing was testing the coherence and comprehensiveness of the system as a representation of life. And for some obscure reason, those 78 cards have done it. They've stabilized into a pattern that reflects reality, as I think it was Eliphas Levi said, a man in prison with nothing more than a deck of tarot cards could figure out the functions of the entire world, could see the entire world reflected in that deck and in its interactions. Now, why 78? I have no idea. Why 22 major arcana? I have no idea. But I do know that, like many other systems that have become useful over time, a bit like a meme, these have stabilized as a reasonably accurate reflection of the life around us. And as a result, they become useful, they become functional. So I do believe that the symbols on the cards, the archetypal patterns that the cards are images of, certainly the major cards, are sufficient enough for it to do its purpose, which is to tell us about life. As to why 78, why 22, maybe a numerologist or quantum physicist will figure that out at some point, but that's not for me to say.
Thank you. Thank you. And a lot of these questions are very interrelated. One of the things that, when I consider tarot, that's so phenomenal is that it's so multifaceted, used for many different things, sometimes simultaneously, divination, meditation, art, symbolism, magic. Could you talk a little bit about all the different uses for tarot and its versatility?
Yeah, for sure. I think it is Emily E. Auger has brilliantly composed an anthology called Tarot in Culture, which is a two-volume anthology which will be released, I think, later on this year by the Association of Tarot Studies, Jean-Michel David in Australia. It's got some incredible papers in, and mine, and it really shows the gamut of how tarot has permeated culture. Now, for me, whilst there are all of these different things, divination, art, I've been studying a lot recently of pervasive gaming, the idea of making real life games, which can be just for experience, they can be educational, they can be management training and so forth, because I believe that tarot can expand out. And in fact, there's a theatre company in Finland who do a interactive theatre where there's hardly any set or stage. You just wander around this area and meet tarot cards. And they direct you in different ways, and they have little vignettes of plays and so forth. To me, I think it's the fact that tarot, and this is something I cover in my paper in that particular anthology, is a placeholder. It is a significator of the liminal. It's a cultural signpost that we need in our society to point to the unknown. There are others, but none so useful as a physical artifact as tarot. All you have to do is show a tarot card to anyone in the street, and we tried this experiment, and say, "What is this?" And they'll say, "Oh, it's a tarot card." And then you can ask, "Well, what tarot cards do you know?" And people will say, the death card, the lover's card, and sometimes they'll know the hanged man. But very few other cards, very few other cards. And then if you ask them, "How do you know this?" They'll go, "I don't know really. It's, And in cultural studies, a friend of mine very kindly gave me a phrase for this, which is illegitimate knowledge. It's knowledge that people have, but they don't know where they got it from. And so tarot is a species of illegitimate knowledge. And it functions in society as I mentioned, as a signpost for the unknown. And I was going to say, without it, we wouldn't be able to, but there is no without it. We have to have it. It has to be there, because we live in a world where there's both known and unknown, and therefore we have something in the middle, and that something in the middle is the language of tarot, however it's expressed through art, divination, fortune telling. To give an example, I once did a reading for somebody at what we call here a car boot sale, like a garage sale, and I was reading the tarot cards, and out of all of those 10,000-12,000 readings, this was the one that had all the bad cards in it. And despite at the time me being more in the school of trying to empower the querent and give some positive counseling type advice, which is not something I tend to do anymore, but at the time I was in that modality, and I was looking at the cards and saying to this young girl, well, that's a really bad card, but on the other hand there's this card which is also really bad, but we usually in a spread like this we look over here and we see that we have more really bad cards. And this reading went on for about 20 minutes, and my wife walked behind me, and all I heard was as she walked by. And I continued the reading, and I said at the end of it, well, I'm really so sorry. And this, again, is not something I would do nowadays, apologize for the reading. I'm really so sorry that I've not been able to give you any hope from this. It seems like you are in a really bad situation, and maybe things will change over time and so forth. And she looked at me as she was sat up, and she could see I was concerned that I'd not done this very good reading. And she said, well, if it's any consolation, I probably won't commit suicide tonight. And I sat there, and my wife came back and said, what was that reading all about? It looked so terrible. I was packing up my cards, and I said, well, we're done here for the day. I'm not going to read anymore. And for years, that reading haunted me. For years, I kept thinking, why did that terrible, terrible reading suggest to that girl that she might not or should not consider suicide? And then it struck me after about 4 or 5 years of it haunting my every waking hour. And that was this. If I'd have given her any other reading, it wouldn't have reflected her real situation. The fact that the reading so accurately reflected her real life situation, her suicidal thoughts, her depression, and so forth, her lack of a future, it told her something, and it told me something, that as Kershaw says about magnetism, the universe is bound by invisible knots. And there were we showing one of those invisible knots in front of us. She had to realize at that point, either implicitly or explicitly, that her life was part of some unknown, invisible, interconnected story of meaning. And that's what the tarot gave her. And I believe that's what tarot gives us through art, through self-discovery, through fortune telling, through divination, through those who collect the cards. It's a signpost, and as such, it's a very dynamic signpost. It's a language over that threshold, backwards and forwards. And that's what I love about tarot.
Thank you. It's beautifully put. And I just wanted to mention, you say right up front on your website that your aim is to restore the spiritual dignity of tarot.
Yeah, it's interesting that that quote, I'll mention where the word tarosophy came from, and then I'll talk about that quote as well, because both of them were given to me. Neither of these are mine, but they were both given to me. with Tarosophy, I had decided to establish a new organization to promote the education of tarot, particularly in popular culture, and to help normalize tarot as a language of the mysteries into culture, because I can see that this is something that it has a functional role already there, but no one is quite taking advantage of that. So in that project, I decided that a tarot organization would be a good thing. And I had looked to trademark various phrases, for example, professional tarotists or tarot professionals and so forth. Tarot Professionals Limited is now the name of our company. But I had tried to trademark a couple of things and had failed, because you have to basically attempt to trademark them and get them turned down until you're successful, which is very good for the trademark people. And I was having a conversation with one of the people in the UK Patents Intellectual Property Office, and he said, well, you've got to think things like Kodak and Hoover and things like this, that they have no connection with the product. It's just a made-up word. So make up a word that has something to do with tarot. And I thought, well, phew. And I tried all sorts of things. And then I suddenly thought, well, I'm a magician. I did the Abramelin ritual. It's full of magical squares. What I should do, and what would be really cool and clever, is to find a magical square with a strange name on it, and I can use that, and I can trademark the name of a spirit from the Abramelin squares, and that would be really, really cool and funny and powerful and clever and so forth. So I got my Abramelin book out, and I was looking through the magical squares, and as people might know, the squares are mishmashes of Hebrew and so forth, and the words sometimes misspelt and don't quite make sense and so forth. And I was really despairing. I thought, I'm not going to come up with anything I can use. And then I was looking at this square and thinking, there's nothing in there. And into my head came Tarosophy. It just was there. And I went, I actually breathed in and thought, that's it, Tarosophy. Tarot, Sophie, Sophia, the wisdom of, the study of, the living wisdom of tarot. Tarot, Sophia, Tarosophy. And I thought, that is just too good to be true. Everybody must have had that. So I looked it up online, and no one had used it. No one had used it. And I thought, wow, this is just really cool. I can now trademark the word, and I will be able to maintain that as a flag post for what it is that I'm teaching and what it is that my vision is and what I'm trying to accomplish with all of this. And I looked at the magical square, and of course it was the square for finding the magic of a word. And I just looked at the square, and I just laughed. I thought, this magic business, it really does appear to work. How cool is that? And so that's where Tarosophy originally came from. And it went through the trademark process, and that was all fine. But at one point in the formation of the organization, Tarot Professionals, we hit a very bad patch, and I was coming in for a lot of criticism, a lot of negativity, all sorts of things were really getting me down. And I just thought at one point, it's just not worth this hassle to promote what I'm promoting. I'll just go back to being a hermit. And Naomi Ozaniak, the author of The Aquarian Kabbalah and various other books, sent me an email, and she said, Marcus, what you appear to be doing is restoring the spiritual dignity of tarot. Keep going. And I just burst into tears, and I said to the people around me, you know, this is it. This is actually what we're trying to do, isn't it? This is what we're trying to achieve, restore the spiritual dignity of Tara. And as Naomi had gifted that to me, and I emailed her and said, please, please, can I use that wonderful phrase? And she said, you know, with all blessings, please do. And that really saved it. I've credited her in the book with words at the darkest hour before the dawn. And those were the words, restoring the spiritual dignity of Tara. Because if she hadn't have sent me that email, I might just have given up and not bothered and not written the book either. So, you know, she is a true priestess by providing the right magic at the right time.
I want to take a few minutes, if you don't mind, because you do discuss this briefly in your book, Tarosophy, the origins of tarot. This seems to be a constantly contentious point, although I've interviewed Robert Place, who seems to have a fairly concrete grasp on the origin of tarot. I just wanted to get your take on it, because I think there is the origin of the cards, which seems pretty clear, and then there's the origin of the imagery, which maybe is a little bit more murky. But because we have to tie specific imagery to specific cards, it gets kind of, I don't know, it seems the interpretations seem not as black and white as might be expected. So I just wondered if you might talk to us about that a little bit.
Sure. I think it's interesting. For example, the Hanged Man is the one that is often used in this, or the Wheel of Fortune. Nowadays, you can read most books and they'll talk about the Wheel of Fortune very blasé, and they'll say it's to do with karma, fate, destiny, and reincarnation. And all of these things are conflated together from so many different cultural perspectives that is, to my mind, if one thinks about it in any depth, quite bizarre that a card could signify synchronicity, synchronous events, the passage of linear time, and yet synchronicity might defy linear time, magic, fortune telling, fate, destiny, karma, which often is not associated with free will, or perhaps it is in certain approaches, and all of these things get conflated into 10 words under one picture, and all of them are entirely separate entities in themselves, and sometimes very conflicting. It's no wonder people have difficulties knowing what a tarot card actually means. But of course, the symbols on the cards are what, I mean, Crowley first pointed this out, are multivalent. They have many meanings. The blindfold on the two, on the woman on the Two of Swords, for example, in the Waite-Smith Tarot, in one reading it might mean avoiding the obvious, in one reading it might mean guilt, and yet it is the same blindfold. So the symbols themselves have sort of stabilized like this matrix of meaning so that we can use it as a tool of divination, divining the world around us. Now, folk like K. Frank Jensen, Robert Place, Dekker and Dumit, all grand historians in different fields approaching the tarot, have very well mined the known knowledge of tarot. And Mary Gray is doing some great work with cartomancy, looking at all of the images of, and she has some beautiful images she's collected of card reading. And I have many books on how to use a deck of playing cards for divination, for fortune telling, irrespective of tarot. So to me, it's not so important how the images have stabilized. To me, it's how the meanings underneath those have become generated, And we did a rather weird experiment with Tarosophy for one of the original teachings in it, which was to come up with the unconscious keywords for some of the cards. So it's a little bit like in therapy, sometimes someone will use a word that sounds quite random, and yet the significance of the etymology of the word has vast and profound meaning to them, even if they don't know the etymology of the word. So quite often I'll ask a client to look up a certain word, and they'll come back and go, wow, that word really reflects, you know, what's going on for me. And the reason is their unconscious has heard that word many, many times in many, many different contexts and come up with a gestalt almost of what that word actually is at root, even though it's not conscious. And we find the same with the tarot card images. Each of those symbols has a meaning that is uniquely the Four of Cups, as opposed to the Three of Cups. But what that actual meaning is quantum physics or fluid dynamic theory has it very well, in the sense of strange attractors. It's something to which a formula tends but never reaches. It never collapses into that state. And yet you can see it's there because of, say, for example, fractals. They revolve around a particular almost center of gravity without it being there, or without it being attainable. And I do believe the same with the tarot cards. Each of those symbols has, like the wheel or the hanged man or the Three of Cups or the Four of Cups, it has a meaning that is actually unobtainable. And yet we all know sort of what that meaning is, because we cycle around it, and the same words and the same keywords and the same ideas and the same responses attract to that card and not the card next to it. And you know, that's my main interest with tarot card symbolism and imagery, how they reflect a system of strange attractors that are exactly the same as the strange attractors that build the cosmology and the universe around us.
It's truly fascinating. All right, Marcus, I'd like to spend a few minutes just talking about some of the correspondences and attributions that we associate with different tarot cards. A lot of these are based on astrology or Kabbalah, and I'm just curious about where this comes from, because you've done a lot of research into this area, and I just wanted to, if you could share some of your findings in terms of that with us.
Surely. I think in Tarosophy we cover the infamous ancient Celtic cross, which is neither ancient nor Celtic nor a cross. It is the ubiquitous spread in every single book, and I've been very interested in following up some of Mary K. Greer's research in that area, and we are hoping to have a collect late in the book as well with the transcript, the typescript, of the first known version of that ancient spread. As I think tarot.com says, this is a spread that has been used for hundreds of years. Well, it's only been used since about the late 1800s. And it was never really designed as a particular cross, and the Celtic appellation to it was only added in the second edition of the Pictorial Key to the Tarot. So, and it was more of a marketing thing, I think, than much else. So we blow out a lot of myths about tarot in Tarosophy. And despite that, there are some very significant correspondences between astrology and tarot used by the designers of comparatively recent tarot decks, for example, the Waite-Smith tarot, the Thoth tarot, more obviously. As an example of Kabbalistic symbolism embedded in the Waite-Smith tarot, for example, the Golden Dawn said that the mystery of Kesheth was one of the primary mysteries that should be known to all adepts. and yet they never really explained anywhere what they meant by that. Now, Kesheth, which is the Hebrew word for rainbow, is composed of three letters, Kof, Shin, and Tau. Those three letters on the Golden Dawn system of correspondences to the Tree of Life are the bottom three paths. And they make a bow, they make a rainbow, the literal meaning of the word Kesheth, above Malkuth, the earth, that's at the bottom of the Tree of Life. So as a picture, this makes perfect sense. The rainbow, the letters, are above the earth, just like in the biblical story. And the Bible does say that that's a symbol of hope and the covenant between man and God, between the above and the below. Now, when we take a look at the rest of the correspondences that the Golden Dawn generated, there's something quite remarkable, and it's one of many remarkable, what can we say, undesigned design features of the universe. What happens is that when you lay out the cards in the system of correspondence according to the Golden Dawn, you end up with temperance attributed to Sagittarius, corresponding to Sagittarius, on the middle pillar above Yesod. It connects Yesod and Tifereth in that system. And it corresponds to Sagittarius. Now, here's the interesting thing. Sagittarius is, of course, the arrow. It's symbolized as an arrow. And it's the arrow that comes out of the bow, which is Kesheth. And when you look at both the drawing of temperance and its position on the Tree of Life, you can see that Coleman Smith really did design it, the angel with the line going across her body, which is the water between the two jars, is the temperance symbol. Now, the chances of those correspondences so beautifully meshing are quite remarkable. And further to that, when you look at the card, most people say on that card in the Waitsmith Tarot, there is an angel. But if you look in the background, there is a picture of an iris. And the iris is from the goddess Iris. Iris is, bizarrely enough, the goddess of the rainbow. She was depicted as a winged form bearing jugs, which is exactly what is on the temperance card. So we have Iris, we have the rainbow, we have the Hebrew letters Kesheth, and we have Sagittarius, the arrow coming out of the bow. And when you draw them on the Tree of Life, they make a bow and an arrow shape in the shape of the paths. And it's just a perfect mapping of one system on top of another, so much so that you can design it. As a final example, I'll leave with the example of Malkuth. Now, in Hebrew, the letters are also words, they're also numbers, and they're also, in effect, sigils or shapes. And Malkuth, the letters for Malkuth, Mem, Lamed, Kof, Vau, Tau. Those letters mean water, ox goad or whip, hand, nail, and cross. So the Hebrew word kingdom embodies in its letters a myth of sacrifice, which is pretty convenient, really. Embeds within it a story, a myth, sort of like Jesus. And it's just really bizarre because no one could have possibly designed that. As an example of what I mean by this, if people read the book Cosmos by Carl Sagan, the very last couple of pages where he talks about the signal breaking down into binary zeros and ones to show that the universe was designed with a message encoded within it, is what I am referring to here, that tarot shows us a universe composed with a message within it.
Wow, that's just fascinating, and I think that's a good illustration of the wisdom and the truth, if you will, that's reflected in these systems.
And as I show in Tarosophy, if people want to learn Kabbalah very quickly through their existing knowledge of tarot, if you take a look at the tarot cards, if you give a group of tarot cards, the tarot cards that illustrate those letters through correspondence, they will automatically come up with a reading that reflects the deeper mysteries of the Sephira Malkuth in the Tree of Life. And as I show in Tarosophy, you can then repeat that for the whole of the Tree of Life and be able to have a fast track into Kabbalah. I've heard tarot readers using this method give perfectly, almost word-for-word descriptions of ancient Hebrew texts about Ketha, Hochma, and Bina by their illustrations through tarot cards. And that's something that I wanted to make very available as a previously private teaching through Tarosophy. So that's in the book.
It's fantastic. Again, Tarosophy, Tarot to Engage Life, Not to Escape It, from Salamander and Sons by Marcus Katz. Just phenomenal, phenomenal book. Highly recommend it. And I will definitely be using it myself. So appreciate it very much. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity if you had any final thoughts about the book.
Not so much. I think it's the first of a number of works that I'm working on. In the meantime, whilst we were waiting for the publication of the book, we produced two other self-published books called Tarot Flip and Tarot Twist. These use broken down ideas, boiled down ideas from Tarosophy as a fast track into reading tarot. So Tarot Flip has keywords for all of the cards and things you should say for each card. But each of the 78 things you should say show a very different way of speaking about the cards to teach people how to really talk through a tarot reading, which is something that students often have a problem with. They go on a class, they read a book, but then they get stuck knowing how to talk. In, you know, what should one say about the card? You have the book meanings, but you can't just read out of the book. So we designed Tarot Flip to allow people to read literally straight out of the box. You can get a beginner, open a box of tarot cards, give them the Tarot Flip book, and they'll be able to start getting over that first hurdle of what do you say. So instead of teaching all the meanings, we teach what you should say first, because that's what people have the difficulties with. And then in Tarot Twist, we give 78 entirely new ways of using tarot. Each of them is not just a different spread, but an entirely different way of using tarot that's never been published before. And there we just wanted to open the box entirely out as a prelude to some of the deeper teachings in Tarosophy to show how tarot can be used as a language. And in both books, we illustrate how one can turn a question into a spread and how one can get a card and its meaning to fit any question. Because again, that's something over the 30 years I've been doing this, most people have difficulties with. I've read this meaning in a book, or I've been taught this meaning, but how does this card fit this sort of question? And we show an NLP modeled way of applying any card to any question. And it's very easy to teach and very easy to learn and very effective. So Tarosophy is the first of a sequence of books that are supported by more practical training manuals as well.
That's excellent. And if you could just remind people where they can find you online, your main website.
Yeah, the main we have two main websites, really. We have tarotprofessionals.com, which is simply www.tarotprofessionals, all one word, .com. And that's our main hub of activity where people can get membership, where we produce the magazines. We now have over 1,000 pages of 10 issues of Tarosophist International magazine, which has now been running for 2 years. The Thoth edition of that is, I believe, an absolute classic. It has everybody who is everybody about the Thoth deck and Crowley writing in it. And that's all available for members on tarotprofessionals.com. And we have Tarot Town, which is www.tarot-town.com. That's the social network for not only members of Tarot Professionals, but for everyone interested in tarot. And that now has, we established that about 6 months ago, and we were aiming for about 800 people in the first year. We currently have 4,500 people on it in 6 months. Wow. And we aim to have maybe about 10,000 in the second quarter of this year. And each of those people, we are teaching tarot. At the moment, we have a 78-day course, which is for free for everybody, and you can join it at any time. And we are just raising the bar on tarot teaching through that. And also on that, we also have Citizen Streets, which has movies from Lon Milo Duquette, Rachel Pollack, Mary Kay Greer, myself, and a few other people to teach tarot. And that's on the Citizen Streets, which is, I think we charge about $12 a year. Yeah, $12 a year for that. But because our main aim with Tarot Town is to really promote high quality teaching of tarot. And the bulk of it is free. So you can just join up, you can get a 78-day course, you can network with other people. We have fast-track guides to Kabbalah, to numerology, to the Sabian symbols, to all sorts of things. And it's a very bustling, busy town full of oracles, fortune tellers, seers, wizards, and wonders.
That's just phenomenal. That's really an amazing resource. And for anyone who wants to learn and has some time, there's no excuse not to check that out.
Thank you.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Marcus Katz and I talk more about tarot, our impressions of favorite tarot decks, tarot philosophy and symbolism, and much more. Don't miss it. The membership section features loads of additional recorded interviews and more for only $7.95 per month. The link to the membership section is on the sidebar of the occultofpersonality.net website, or just browse to occultofpersonality.net/membership.